This is Swan, and you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Today, I am excited to introduce a relatively recent new friend, but feels like I've known you for ages. I'm here with Jennifer, officially, Jennifer Decker, who is a writer and a reader and just a lovely human being, and I'm grateful to be talking to her today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Looks like our sound levels are solid, and we're doing an experiment with a new recorder, so we'll see how it goes. And so some things about you, and you can add to this, because you don't have a big online presence, so it's hard to find out who you are by Googling you. But you are a MALS graduate from Dartmouth. So the MALS is a Master's of Arts in Liberal Science.
Liberal Studies,
Liberal Studies. And you wrote your thesis on class division in American culture, which sounds fascinating, and I think we've talked about it a little bit, but I realized as I was prepping that I haven't read anything you've written, so we might talk about that. And when I met you, you also talked about a project with adult children's books, and I was fascinated by this because I think it came about, we were talking about coloring books and how funny they are that we have adult coloring books.
Makes good sense.
Bless me.
Adults need to have fun too.
We do, and sometimes, I mean, children's books have depth to them that people, I think, know, and that's why they are popular. Mm-hmm. Even, like, a lot of my friends read YA and children's books, and some of them have to because they're educators, and some of them don't have to, and they just read them because they make them happy.
Makes sense to me.
So, anything else we should add here? You are generous person, a good person. In your free time, you read
a lot.
A lot. Yeah.
Same goes.
Same?
Same goes. I figure you're a really nice, generous person too, so thank you.
We'll just compliment each other for now.
That sounds great. Let's do that.
It'll be a great show.
Adults need that too.
So let's start with the MALS program that you got a master's from Dartmouth.
Yep.
And you came here from Colorado, I know that much. And then Dartmouth became your home. Do you want to talk about how you found the program and your experience as you were working through it?
Sure. When I was an undergrad in Colorado, I hadn't anticipated going on to get a graduate degree, but I had a great professor who really encouraged me to apply to a number of programs, all of them in the Ivy League. Now at this point, I was still a non-traditional student.
Was that daunting?
It was. And I had come into my undergrad program 10 years older than everybody, with a child. I had dropped out of high school. The thought of hitting the Ivy League was pretty hardcore, but he encouraged me, and so I did. And I applied to all the ones that were about as far away from Colorado as I could get. And I did my interview with Dartmouth, and they accepted both my wife and I, which made it a really easy decision to sort of come and move everybody to Hanover. And we just, we did the 2,500 miles across the states with the cat and the kid in the back. And it was probably the best decision I've ever made in my life.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So I really like hearing about mentors who carve out paths. And it sounds like this was a person who did that for you. Do you want to speak to that at all? What am I trying to say here? It sounds like this experience of not considering something until someone suggests that it's possible and believes that you could do it.
Yeah.
And
it's empowering, right?
Yeah.
That happened to me when I first went to undergrad and then when I left. So, I wasn't on a path to any sort of monetary success or even life success. I was just taking care of my son, and I had three jobs, and one of my coworkers suggested that I go to college. And I didn't think they'd ever let me in, but I applied anyway because she was very adamant that she thought I would be successful there.
And you were.
And then I was, right. Yeah, so I made the dean's list. I graduated with honors and, finished up ahead of the class. And then at the end of that class, I still didn't have that sort of self-awareness. I was planning on maybe, joining military service, just something so that I could make sure I could provide for my son. And I had this professor who had asked the class, sort of as a whole, what are your plans following graduation? And I had said, I just want to do something that to make sure that my son is provided for, potentially doing military or something like that, something in that vein. And he said, no, you have to go to graduate school. And he helped me with my applications. He made sure that I was confident and knowledgeable during my interviews. He gave me a sterling recommendation and I got into Dartmouth. So, and thank God, because now it's been 3 years. I graduated last year. And because of those two, really, there have been a lot of people to help along the way, of course, but those two people in particular are the reasons that I got to a place where I could empower myself, because they gave me that opportunity to see myself differently.
And see your future differently.
Yeah.
I'm glad that happened, because now I was able to meet you. I'm curious, after being a high school dropout, what was the hardest part about transitioning back into academia on an undergraduate and on a graduate level?
As an undergrad, the first thing I was concerned with was making sure I had enough money to take care of my son.
Oh, it's huge.
And as a graduate, I didn't think that would be such an issue, but it definitely was. Although, you know, coming from the sort of poverty that I did, I mean, I had been living in the projects with my kiddo. Going to school meant that I was eligible for student loans. Mm-hmm. So even though I have student loan debt now that I'll probably be paying off for life, the fact is that I was able to better provide for my son. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting change.
But the anxiety, we've talked about this, the anxiety never really goes away.
No.
Being afraid of not having enough.
Not having enough and wondering if, you know, how it's going to be next month or next year.
Yeah.
But in undergrad, I was a full decade older than my peers.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I can reflect on it, at the time, that was really daunting. I felt like I was behind everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But in reflection, because I'd had that life experience, everything sort of moved me in different ways. I was able to make connections with the real world in ways that my fellow students were not. And I see that now in reflection as a real positive. And at the time, it felt pretty terrifying. But it actually provided me with kind of a better handle. And I'm a firm advocate of like gap years and taking a break because of that.
America doesn't really subscribe to that, but I know that a lot of Europeans will have a year between high school and I think there definitely is a maturity that helps you appreciate what you're doing.
That's exactly
rather than
right.
just like having to grind through it.
It's the appreciation. Coming to Dartmouth was different. It was definitely the fear of not being good enough. I had the imposter
and
syndrome.
Ivy Ling.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm not supposed to be here.
Really not.
How did you tackle that, or did you just persist despite it?
I'm a pretty head-on kind of person. So the first paper that I turned in, the night I turned it in and I put it in the box and I'm like, oh, I'm going to fail. This is going to be awful. They're going to kick me out of school because if you don't maintain, you know, it's pass or fail. And if you don't pass, then that's it. Yeah, you get dismissed from the program. So I turned in that paper and I was in the car and I just like sat there in the car just weeping a huge amount of tears thinking this is it. And, you know, a week and a half later I get my paper back and it was great and I aced it. And then I sort of just went forward from there. I tried not to second guess myself as much. I think that is something that will always be hard for me, but it's easier now.
I'm fascinated by imposter syndrome, possibly because I feel like a lot of time it blockades me from my potential. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions on ideas of how you
get outside of that box?
I mean, I think part of it's just being stubborn and sticking to something despite what's going on in your mind. But what do you think about people who are successful despite this imposter syndrome?
I think a huge part of it is reaching out, because once you realize that you're not the only one who feels
it's huge.
It is. So we ended up, in that class, my first class at Dartmouth, for instance, we ended up going out in that first term with a bunch of other students. And we sat and we, you know, had some food and talked a little bit. And in the first, I don't know, 30 minutes, everybody was talking about that first paper, the conversation, or how they felt. And we made this community where we felt like everybody could be honest with feeling like in some ways they're just not good enough, and it just depended on where they had come from or how hard they pushed themselves or their, you know, parental issues, whatever it happened to be. Essentially, I found the group where we were all in the same boat, and I realized that I wasn't alone in feeling like that. Everybody here feels like that. Everybody across the board feels like that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having that community just makes it so much easier to process your own feelings of self-worth.
Yeah. Why is this so psychologically potent to know that you're not the only one that feels this way? Yeah, and sometimes it's easy to forget, which actually is a nice segue into our poem, I think, in an abstract way. So we did a river writing session before the show. If you guys are unfamiliar with river writing, it's a free write based on a poem. So as I read a poem, you find the line that stands out to you, and then you set a timer and just write and just like brain dump whatever comes. No judgment. Don't worry about spelling. Don't worry about legible writing, just like let it come out. And acknowledge, like, this is doesn't have to be good. It's just something you're doing. So the poem we read today was called Keeping Quiet by Pablo Neruda. And it goes like this. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once, on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness if we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving. And for once could do nothing. Perhaps a huge silence might interrupt the sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12. And you keep quiet, and I will go. I like it.
I love that poem.
It's a nice poem. And so I invite you, do you have any interest in reading what you wrote?
If I can read my handwriting, I'm happy to.
Do you want to give it a whirl? I can go first, too, if you want.
Yes, you go first.
I'll go
that
first.
That makes me feel so much more secure. See, not alone.
Not alone. So, yeah. No explanations too, which is the hardest part because I want to explain why this is what it is. But that's kind of a part of the practice, is it takes the pressure off.
Letting that go.
Silence interrupting sadness. These games of the mind to have loneliness aching deep in your chest, even when in a room full of people, sometimes especially when they are people you know and love. Some days I wake up feeling sad and lonely and full of melancholy, and I feel like maybe this is not a matter of will or of circumstance, but a complex part of this human experience. This loneliness scares us. It scares me. I feel a panic rising, and I reach for some distraction rather than the discomfort of sitting with it. I long to meditate, but perhaps fear my own mind. I fear what memories and ideas will arise when I stop moving for even one moment. I want to just visualize light up my spine, rooted in the earth and coming out of my head. I want to be a tree. I want to focus on my breath or on my mantra. But it is not pretty. It is not peaceful. It is not safe, this sitting with the mind. Listen, observe, attend, create space. Invite stillness and it should get easier, right? Yet sometimes when you feel lonely, the only thing to do is be lonely. Pour a glass of wine. Draw a warm bath and invite this loneliness with gentle compassion.
That sounds lovely.
Thanks.
And now I want a bath and a glass of wine.
Can be arranged, probably.
Bubble bath. Okay. I'm not sure I can read this, but I'll give it a shot,
yeah.
Okay?
Just skip the words that don't make sense.
Everything proves to be alive. That was part of that poem.
Mm-hmm.
Holding hard breath, pain in the chest, a burn, a smile. I know the living, the breath, essential. My brethren, why do I keep you so close to my heart? To be deterred in the winter, the dark of souls. Lost, painful breath. Yet the smile holds fast, shining. Shining like sun through the rain, your gentle laugh revealing truth. Youthful trust. Why? The broken teetering. Why the gritted teeth? When your spring soul pushes through, is it worth it? My family, my human family, all of us feeling twined of hearts. Love of you moves me, and your grace makes way in the cold, hard winter of lost souls. My dream, to hold that spark, your humanity, so near to my womb, to warm it, to nurture it. While in body, I am cold, and in mind, I am now numb. Knowing that in seeing your flicker and holding the fire close, while winds of death, of destruction, of persecution hit me and hit us, that when they still together we will kindle again, the fire within the connective burn, this beautiful light, this spring, the sun, and it breaks.
Thank you. And then I think what I would love to hear about class division in American culture. How did that become your thesis, and what is the Cliff Notes version?
Cliff Notes thesis. So my working thesis was a quantitative and qualitative study on what I like to call the glass ceiling of poverty, which is something that a lot of people don't realize exists, but I had the opportunity to live through and then reflect upon. It has a lens of being able to look at individual lived experience and seeing where people are coming from in their cultural and their physical and their cognitive abilities, and how at different tiers of the, you know, sort of American socioeconomic strata, that can further divide you and defer you from getting to goals that you might have in your heart and in your mind, right? Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to, you got your high school diploma, and you wanted to apply for a job, and you went in, but you dressed in ways that someone thought were inappropriate. You spoke with a sort of, in a way that people thought was different, or you presented yourself just through body language, through prior knowledge, your historical sort of, your own path. You know, a lot of people will talk about, oh yes, I've been traveling there, or, you know, here are my different experiences. So when you come from a very different culture and you're trying to break into what is a completely different culture socioeconomically, this can create barriers of trust, of understanding, of dispersion of knowledge. Yeah. And I feel like that's something that hasn't been talked about enough.
And you get, I mean, I think especially with appearance and gesture, you get dismissed for the smallest inconsistencies that you were never taught. Like,
right.
It's this funny thing that you have to know how to play the game.
I knew a 50-year-old who went into a job interview and was very comfortable with the woman that she was interviewing with, and swore during the interview because they had been bantering back and forth.
Yeah.
And she didn't get the job, and it was because in that split second, she had done something that this other person didn't feel was socially right. And she couldn't figure out what it was, because they seemed to be in this comfortable space, but even though it was comfortable for her, it was comfortable professional for this other person. And so I feel like having the conversation to break down those barriers is really important to this struggle for social equality.
And bias. How do you step outside bias? I mean, you've had life experiences that offer a perspective larger than most, perhaps. When you're encountering someone from a different culture, just because different life experiences, you bring all of your biases. How did you tackle that? Did you talk to people about that?
I mean, I'm lucky because I've gotten to a point in my life now where I try not to let my prior experiences sort of rule where I'm at in the room, but it certainly wasn't always like that. And I mean, all of us do to a certain extent. And I'm certainly in rooms where, you know, where I have to code switch. So I did a lot of linguistics study, a lot of anthropology, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I go to, say, a Dartmouth event as a staff member, then there are certain things that I will do. I speak with a different cadence. I speak with a different cadence, and I dress in ways that cover my tattoos, and I don't speak to anybody about my, you know, illegitimate son, or the fact that I'm a lesbian, or that I was a dropout from high school. I very much do this conversation of, oh yes, I've been to London, yes, Dartmouth is lovely in the springtime, the whole thing. And it's not that I'm not being real, I'm just choosing these parts of my persona. And the flip side of that is, when I sneak out for a smoke, and I did this just last week, I was at a 2 weeks ago, I was at a dinner engagement, and I ran outside to go have a smoke, and I went behind the hotel where the employees go, and I sat there with them, and we talked in very broken English with a lot of swearing, and I, you know, put my feet up on the table, and we had our cigarettes, and it was relaxing. It was very much at the core part of how I visualized myself and where I'm comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then I pulled it back together and I went back in and presented this very different person, you know.
Yeah, it makes me think of Tara Clancy. She grew up in Queens and she talks like this, and she like listening to her is like 90% of the enjoyment of her writing. Mm. But she recently released a book called The Clancys of Queens. Mm. And she's been on Story Slam. What is this?
The Moth.
Mm. And she moderates Moth as well. And I'm giving too much background perhaps, but that's something that she actively talks about and addresses as code switching, and mm. how like you have to switch from different, because she's, I think, similar to you, the Queen's like very rough but interesting background, and then grad student, and that's just had to do the whole academic game, and now has like the ability to switch between these different things, but also hates that she has to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And wants, I mean,
it's frustrating. I mean, we all code switch to a certain, like, there's a certain persona you have if you're going to visit with your parents or your children,
yeah.
your best friend versus, a colleague or something. But being hyper aware of the code switching you have to do in order to be in a cultural or socioeconomic yeah. echelon, it's irritating, because you know that the response that you would get if you're going to be really real is very different
than the cultivated
right
persona.
And it's that response that we're conditioned to have, but especially when you come from something that is looked down upon, it doesn't sound good for you.
Yeah, I think just moving from one circle to another, the circle doesn't understand the other circle, so you have to change
right
your behavior.
And there's things that don't translate, so you're trying to explain these concepts of what it means to be in this sphere to this other sphere, because that's how change occurs.
Yeah, dialogue.
But you can't necessarily, it's like speaking another language. There are some things that don't translate. You actually have to have the lived experience. And so, but asking somebody to, okay, well, why don't you go for a week on a food stamp diet, 12-hour days on your feet with no support and people looking down on you, and then we can have this conversation. And realistically, that's just not an option for most people.
Yeah. I think that was something revolutionary in my life when I realized that I didn't always have to be comfortable.
Mm.
And I think people actively avoid any kind of experience that would give them empathy because it's uncomfortable. I had another thought. I think it's gone though. Well, maybe we'll revisit it. I think we're gonna have a coffee heating up break and potentially a smoking break, but I have to remember how to pause, or I have to read how to pause. So I feel like this is a great time to break and read an announcement for Radio Free Brooklyn and related to Brooklyn Pride Week, which is actually appropriate, even though we won't be there. So there's Brooklyn Pride. The theme is Equality, No Exceptions. It is Monday, June 5th through Saturday, June 10th. Where is it? There's a 5K in Prospect Park. A festival and parade on Fifth Avenue in Park Slope. That's right where I used to live. That's exciting. There's also a documentary of Firstly Open Trans FDNY Firefighter, queer comedy, and a full day of events on Saturday, June 10th. There's a website, brooklynpride.org, if you'd like to learn more about events and how you can get involved. And an exciting year because Brooklyn Pride is turning 21. And let me see if there's anything else that I need to read. Nope, that's sounds
fabulous.
That's good. And also just checking in, if you just tuned in, this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. We're a show about books, writing, and everything and anything else that comes up. And we're glad you listen. And remember, please, that donating is loving. So if you like what you hear, either with this show or any other show, check out different ways you can support, even just $1 a month. That's like less than a coffee, and it really does help. So plug that. And then I remembered what I was going to say earlier that I forgot. As you were talking about your thesis, which was class division in American culture, and we started talking about different cultures. And I was having a conversation with my dear friend James, and I was talking about relationships, because that's what I talk about sometimes. But I was talking about fears that I had about culture and differences in culture and relationships. And his point was that no one has had the collective life experiences that I have had, and therefore no one actually has the same culture that I have. And then it follows that so is the case with everyone else, that you can have things that are similar, but really, I think all the billions of people on this earth, we all just carry our own culture with us, and certain things resonate with it, and certain things feel foreign, but it's completely individual to you and your life experience. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. I actually, in my anthropological research, so there's actually a vein of thought that goes there. So there was a band of anthropologists who thought, you know, I'm going in and I'm looking at this culture. I'm looking at, say, this band of people of 10 and seeing how they talk and how they dress and everything else. And then, you know, they had this really fundamental realization that, first of all, yes, everybody's individual experience is different. And not only that, but their individual experience as I'm writing it is a reflection of me, not necessarily a reflection of them. Yeah. And so what ended up happening was this sort of postmodern anthropological writing where the anthropological author would just speak to what they saw, how they felt, how they noticed, how they read this cultural area. And it brought some really positive reflections to the table. But there was a flip side to it, and the flip side to that is
you're putting all your judgments on,
right,
knowingly or unknowingly.
Right. And so you can't have any relevant data to sort of move things forward, because in order to have relevant data that people will look at, statistics and things like that, you have to have a cohort, right? So what ended up happening is there's sort of a blend now where you have, yes, this is me as an individual and my take on this, but here are some of the very similar things that I noticed in groups A, B, and C, etc. Yeah. And it's sort of similar with languages.
Data collection, what was your data collection process for your...
For my thesis?
I just talked to thousands of people and then try and sieve down some threads.
I'm an oral historian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the process is like you have to go through the institutional review board in order to make sure,
yes,
that you're not causing harm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, that you're giving a lot of resources and you're making sure that people know. So because of my line of questioning, there definitely could be harm.
Yeah, some PTSD triggers and
absolutely,
yada, yada, yada.
So I had to have, you know, have people sign off on that, have a relevant list of areas where they could go for aid if they felt they needed to speak to somebody or mm-hmm. became suicidal, etc. But I also had a follow-up list, because these are people I was speaking to who are really in the lower echelon of socioeconomic status in this area. So food banks and homeless shelters and places where they can get a warm meal, etc. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the other things that I brought to the table, which was kind of great. So yeah, I went out into the community and I found several different niches of people and sat and recorded our conversations. And then I also did a qualitative sheet, which just had, you know, questions 1 through 25 as far as housing, food security, daycare, education, healthcare, etc., so that I could sort of run those numbers and mm-hmm. brace that number against the sort of holistic personal story that was coming out. So it was a lot of work, but it was an incredibly rewarding work.
I think just giving voice to all these voices that otherwise
don't get heard.
Yeah,
I think
except by each other, which is like not the dialogue that's going to be productive.
So my conclusion to my piece, mm-hmm. and the reason that I wanted to blend the qualitative and quantitative was because in our society, we get a lot of statistics, mm-hmm. you know, and statistics aren't people. Statistics don't have feelings and families and backstories and futures.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to show is that a statistic is also a person.
Put a face to it.
Because that makes a difference, especially when you're going into the house, you're going into the Capitol, and you're saying, you know, here's what we need to change, and here's someone's story as to why. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And there are 40 other ones where this came from.
Yeah. But it's rough. Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about your writing. So you were in the MALS program,
mm-hmm.
and it required writing. Did you see yourself as a writer before then? As a writer, an identity that you've always had? Talk to me about that.
I think I've been writing since I was old enough to sort of hold a pen.
Mm-hmm.
it wasn't all good.
Never is.
But it was definitely a way for me to process life events. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think about it. I wasn't educated enough to realize that that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But as I grew older, I realized that it was a really fundamental piece of who I am, and it was really important in order for me to process things in a way that not just made sense, but gave me a way to sort of move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. But more than that, I like being creative. So when my child was younger, when I see other friends' children now, I have a tendency to make up a lot of stories and do sort of the, you know, going back and forth and how can we make up a story together.
Mm-hmm.
And with children, it's very entertaining.
What did you call yourself? An oral traditionalist?
Oral historian.
Oral historian.
Mm-hmm.
Talk more about that. Are you just a collector of stories and archetypes, or you really appreciate the stories that come out, like, through conversation, through words, or...
Everybody has a story.
Yeah.
Everybody... Humans are a multitude of stories. And I remember when I was a kid and I used to be, you know, in the passenger seat of the car, and I'd see somebody walking down the sidewalk and I would think, what is their, you know, what are they doing? Where are they going? How do they feel about
story?
That? Yeah. Why are they, what are they thinking about? And yeah, I think every time I get into a conversation, even if I stop for gas at the gas station now and I go in and I'm talking to the cashier and I'm like, how's your day? And they say, you know, I didn't sleep last night. The baby was up. Oh my mm-hmm. gosh, you know, what was that like? And how old's the baby? And I get to see pictures. And honestly, I love humans. I feel like everybody's my brother sort of a thing, right? It's just mm-hmm. something that I was born with. And when I worked in a nursing home, there are so many stories there.
Yeah, I called bingo at a nursing home once. And... it was delightful because there's this population of people who are so forgotten but have so much that they're carrying. Oh, kitten. We have a kitten here who's coughing a little bit. That's the noise you hear. And what about writing now? How do you still use it as an active tool? Do you write for pleasure? Do you write consistently?
I wish I did.
It's hard to maintain a practice.
It is.
That's why it's called a practice, I think.
That sounds exactly right. In the last year, I haven't really written a lot. Finishing my thesis last year, I've sort of...
kind of burns you out.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot, though.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot, and I feel like that's really motivation to get back to writing. And so I've written a few short things in the last year, mostly funny things, and readying myself for... the project that I had talked to you about.
Yeah, adult children's books.
Adult children's
which
books.
Which the world needs more content.
It does.
Like that. I'm curious about deadlines. Mm. What, and completion, probably because that's like the thing that every writer struggles with. Having an idea and then being able to let it develop, and then, you know, some things need to be dropped. Mm. This is like a thing that happens. You start working on something, it's exciting, and then all of a sudden nothing is working and you have to set it aside, and sometimes you can revive it and sometimes it just needs to be composted.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I know it's like an external deadline that I care about. If it's a self-imposed deadline, not gonna happen. if it's a deadline for like some sort of a course that I don't care about, not gonna happen. Yeah, but if it's like something that I like, oh, I care what my professor thinks about me, or I care about showing up prepared for the other students in the class, that's the only time I can actually like have like a thing. I feel like the rest of the time is just ideas that never quite become a thing,
right? Percolate to the top.
What do you think about completion?
I think I'm gonna go back to this culture thing and say, for each individual, it's a very writing is a very different culture, right? So I can speak to my experience, but everybody's is going to be so different.
What's your experience?
My experience is that if I allow myself the time and space to work on the idea, the passion that's burning under the surface, whatever it happens to be at that moment, then it's going to flow like water. And what's going to happen is I'll just go through that flow, and then I'll come back and I'll rework it and compost things or make words fit better, a sentence is stronger, make it make more sense. And for me, the deadline doesn't matter so much. What matters to me is being able to read it and knowing that I got the feeling that I felt at that moment across on the page. So somebody reading it can have that same experience as much as possible with our brain, you know, differences as humanly possible. So yeah, that's my experience with writing.
I like that. You're kind of chasing a feeling, which reminds me of Mary Oliver, a poet who talks about being in the field sometimes. I think it's Mary Oliver. And she'll be in a field and then this line will just come to her. And sometimes she can grab a notebook and write it down really fast, but sometimes she doesn't have something, so she has to run back to her house. And then she talks about grabbing that line by the tail and how it literally comes to her word for word backward. And then she has to flip it. And I just love this experience you're talking about, where just you're like really trying to capture this emotion and follow that feeling. I think that's what motivates people to write, is trying to like capture something uncapturable.
Absolutely.
But as close as you can get.
Yeah.
Let's talk about books.
Books. I love books.
The books in your life recently.
Besides coffee, books are my second great love.
Wrinkle in Time.
Did read A Wrinkle in Time recently. Again.
Yeah, and you also reread a book that infuriated you. So that's it. I want to talk to you, T.C. Boyle.
Yeah.
And you reread books, which is something I just started doing probably a year and a half ago. Like, talk about this. Is this something you've always done? And then also please share your second read of T.C. Boyle. What was the title?
Well, I reread books all the time, and there's a reason for that. So if a book gives me a particular feeling for instance, so Small Gods, right? Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett, right? Two great
good
authors.
Good Omens.
And It was Terry Pratchett who did the Small Gods and the Discworld series, right?
Yeah, I haven't read either of those. I need to.
There's
certain things you need to read, and that's a thing.
Those books I could reread. I could read them every day and never be bored because they managed to capture those feelings for me that I look for to experience. And so rereading them gives me that experience, you know, the same as drinking coffee in the morning. I'm creating an emotional experience. So, but some books I reread because the T.C. Boyle infuriated me. The Terranauts.
Like Terra, like planet, like yes. Earth. T-E-R-R-A.
Yes.
Not.
Terranauts. Because when I got to the end, there wasn't a conclusion.
Didn't tie everything in a nice little bow for you.
I was so frustrated.
So you reread it hoping for clues. Did you find any?
I did find some. And actually, I found out that if you go to the end of this particular book, and probably any that T.C. Boyle does, I get the feeling that he is this style of writer. When you go back to the beginning and start reading it, knowing what you know from the end, this 508-page book, the conversation is very different because now you have all these lenses to look through.
Yeah.
And so rereading it from the lens of knowing these people further on, you start to pick up on those clues, and that's what you need. So I think, I don't know if this is the vanity of the writer, but you actually have to reread the work more than once to know.
You have to work for it.
You do. You really can't
just,
do.
It's not like beach reading where you can just like fall into a story and then move on.
Yeah. Most books I just reread for pleasure. Like the Harry Potter series, when I was break for the winter, I just read it beginning to end because that's what I wanted.
Why not? My revisitation of Harry Potter is through the audiobook read by Jim Dale.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've said this before, but it's fantastic. And it really brings to truth for me this, like, audio tradition in storytelling. And, like, it's a cultivated experience when someone's telling you a story. And they've done work to make it a sensational thing and to give voices to characters. And, and yeah, it's just really
That's the
nice.
Job. This is why it's so beautiful when you get an oral history of somebody, because it's a story. It's not a fictional narrative, but it has all of the beauty of that in the real world.
So give me maybe 3 or 4 more recent reads that you would recommend.
The Kids of Appetite.
Uh-huh. Oh, you said that I would like that.
You would love that story. You would love that story because sideways hugs, it's a thing.
Also, I have to like document this. will you say you were talking about me?
Mm-hmm. I was talking about you, and I was talking about how I know how you're a very strong person. You're a very petite person, but somebody asked if I don't know, if you could help move boxes or something during a move, and I thought, yeah, Swan can absolutely do it. Why? Because she's a very strong person. How do you know she's a strong person? Because she gives the best hugs. She gives the best hugs. She hugs you and is really real. And that's the truth. You do.
That's my favorite compliment.
This book, there's a boy in this story who talks about people. And he talks about people as real hugs and sideways hugs. And sideways hugs are those kind of people who are just very surface.
You feel cheated.
Yes.
You walk away and you're like,
and he'll be like, that person is a sideways hug. And I think you would just really like this narrative. But it's an interesting story. And the protagonist, you find out, has not a disability, but a difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're knee-deep in the story before you realize it.
Mm.
And I really love that. I love that it's not the main point.
One of the classes I took, this woman introduced a story where someone was in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me, I've never read a book about someone in a wheelchair.
Right.
Diversity in books, people.
Right.
Like, let's recreate real experiences.
This is why I've been reading a lot of Swedish authors lately. Because
they're
all like that.
Oh,
all
nice.
The protagonists are very...
They're human.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we've got... what was that book called?
So that book is called The Kids of Appetite.
The Kids of Appetite.
Yes. David Arnold, and any book by David Arnold... Fabulous. I've read them all now because I have a tendency to do that.
You're a completionist.
Yes, I am. So I read Fredrik Backman, Swedish author, recently, and I started with one story. I did the same thing. I collected all the stories until I'd read them through.
I envy that. I wish I could do that. I get bored of one author's voice if I read everything in one go.
You wouldn't get bored with him. Because I feel very similar. But once I hit this Swedish author, his voices are so different throughout the story. So the one is told from the perspective of a little girl who's learning things about her grandmother. One is told from the perspective of a very grumpy old man.
What?
And a cat. Right? Because,
okay.
You know, that's totally normal. And it goes on like this.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Anything else that you feel like would be a good recommendation?
So, I started reading recently The Dreamers. I haven't been able to complete it yet because it's intense. But it's beautifully written. It's a very important story, a very relevant story to our times as well, and I highly recommend it. Even though it's hard to read.
What about books you don't like?
Are there books I don't like?
I don't know. Do they exist?
I love books. I'm a lover of books. I think there's stuff that I'm less gravitate. I don't gravitate as much to nonfiction.
Mm.
Just because I really enjoy getting into a story and being somewhere else. But I think that all books, any time that you've taken the time to write down something that was in your heart or in your perspective or in your experience, it's valuable. It's worthwhile. Everybody who has that in them has to write, because if you're not writing down that, you're cheating the world of that passion, that dream. It's all valuable. Even the shit is valuable.
Thank you for saying that. I think that's a healthier perspective than the judgmental perspective that I have, perhaps. Of like, oh, why would anyone want to read that? This has no value.
I highly advocate reading children's books.
Yes.
Because they can bring laughter back to the soul.
Any specific books that you would say start here if you're overwhelmed by it? Because there's a lot of children's books.
So I'm going to go back to the Shel Silverstein. Mm. Anything by Shel Silverstein.
Will you recite your poem?
My favorite Shel Silverstein poem. My hair grows to my toes. I never wears no clothes. I wraps my hair around my bear and down the road I goes.
Yay!
But anything by Shel Silverstein is fabulous.
This is why you should have a poem memorized, just in case you ever need to.
It makes me happy.
I lost that practice, but I used to have a lot memorized. Well, actually getting to the end-ish part of our show. Time flies when you're having fun. And I like to end my show with a series of rapid-fire questions.
She didn't tell me this.
Surprises. It's no fun if you have time to prepare. So the first question I'm going to ask is also related to books. I do feel like when people are an adolescent, there's like a book that changes them, that suddenly makes you feel something or see something differently, and you're different. It's like the book that like helped you become an adult. Does anything come to mind for you of like the book that you read during puberty that made you...
A Yellow Raft on Blue Water.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of this book.
My English professor gave it to me.
A Yellow Raft on Blue Water.
Said, you need to read this. And he was right.
Nice. I'll put it on my list. We'll see if I ever get to it. Next question, a little bit more silly. What is your current streaming addiction, like, to watch or listen podcasts?
Well, just having been introduced to Spotify yesterday.
That's your latest addiction.
That's my latest addiction. I've rediscovered my love for music online. I just finished a series that was called... Oh, I forget now.
What the was Hulu it? Series yes. with the funny cops?
Yes.
Maybe it will come to you. I don't know what it was called either.
Okay, I like that... I like anything that's kind of comedy. Me but too. I did watch Perception. I finished that about a month ago. And again, really enjoyed it because here, you know, your protagonist is someone who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia and is battling schizophrenia, but also doing this whole Sherlock thing. And I love Sherlock.
Oh, yeah.
And so now you have this protagonist with a mental health issue, which really brings to the forefront all these different... social things that I'm really interested in solving, and at the same time, I mean, solve crimes, let's do it.
Nice.
Other questions?
I have a few more, but it's been a while since I've asked them, so I was actually just having a brain gap. And so a similar question to what I just asked is, have you ever read a book that you've disagreed with?
Absolutely.
What comes to mind?
I took a philosophy course, and we had this 900-page book, and it was about our whole conversation was about people who were pro-choice or not, and the book was a really interesting discussion of how personhood doesn't actually develop until you're 2 years old. And so this author was essentially saying, if you murder your child before the age of two, there shouldn't be repercussions because there's no personhood established yet. They're basically still living off of the mothership.
That's heavy.
As a person, while I could understand the the frontal lobe, you know, developing and the whole, you know, personhood development thing. I would say that I didn't take that author's line of thinking well. I didn't take it well. And it was pretty intense, but it was meant to be. This was something that we needed to start a conversation with in class, right? That's what he was going for. But.
Ooh, that's I'm still processing that a little bit. Let me ask how you find your books. It seems like you read a lot, but you definitely, I think it sounds like you cultivate what you read. So how do you find the books that you read?
So my favorite outing of the week is going to the library. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I usually think of one author that I've really liked, say, this week. And I go to that area and I look for other authors in the same venue. And then I go and I talk to the librarians. I love you, librarians. Shout out to librarians.
They are the best, and they're tenacious.
They have this obscure knowledge. They're like, here's this book that nobody reads. That's if you so read it, good. It's going to change your life. So I go by a librarian picks, and then I sort of wander and see what hits me, whether it's the title or the cover art or the first page or just the way somebody writes, the synopsis. And I usually get a collection about, you know, 2 or 3 feet high, and then I come home and I weed through them. And
do you ever not finish books?
I have a really hard time with that. Even if I don't like it or I'm not really into it, I
started not finishing books because there's a lot of books.
I mean, I do, but it's really rare because I have a hard time. I need closure.
Yeah, I get that too. Because I used to do that. And then I'd realize how many hours it took to read this book that I really. And I would, like, reflect. I'm like, I didn't enjoy 1 minute of that.
I learned speed reading at Dartmouth, so this is the time to implement it.
So you're like, just get through it.
Yep.
I actually have, I'll, like, just turn pages and be like, okay, generally, what's going
that's
to happen?
That's exactly right.
Yes, that's real. All right, people, thanks for listening. This has been Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. And if you have any thoughts, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, jokes, I don't know, anything.
Lamentations.
You can email me all lowercase, all spelled out, inkandworm@gmail.com. And I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Gemütlich. It's a German word. I do my head toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling? Good as hell. Head toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling? Good as hell. Shoulders off, keep it moving, yes Lord, trying to get some new shit in there, swimwear, going to the pool shit, come now, come dry your eyes, you know you a star, you can touch the sky, I know that it's hard, but you have to try, if you need advice, let me simplify, if he don't love you anymore, just walk your fine ass out the door, I do my I've been saving for